Well, good morning. We will, my topic has been pursuing your spouse. And I'm going to be kind of floating around through the book, the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. And so most of the text will be in there. So if you've got your Bibles, you might want to get there. But the premise, I'm going to start with something a little un-Calvary-esque. I'm going to start with an idea that's not necessarily rooted in Scripture, but kind of in kind of human psychology a bit, if you will. I'm going to present to you the ideas like if we're going to pursue our spouse, we need to know our spouse. And if we're going to know our spouse, we kind of need to know what's unique about men and women, because it doesn't come intuitively. Men know about men. And women know about women, but when you start to mix the thing up, it gets a little bit squirrely. So the idea is to kind of figure out a little better about the desires. And so I went looking for something that I thought was marketed just to women, not something they need, just something that they want to like, because advertisers don't waste money, do they? They spend a huge amount of research and time, and I thought, I'm wondering if there's anything we could learn from something that's marketed to women. And so I'm going to look at romance novels. So let's see if we can get one up here. Do we have it there? Boom. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a couple of questions to see if you just kind of notice if there's a pattern here. Are her eyes open or closed? Closed. They're closed. And so she's not really looking at him, but he's obviously looking at her. He's looking, and if you will, if his eyes are open, he'd be looking straight into her eyes. If his eyes are closed, he's looking at her with his heart, right? And you also notice that she's in his arms, his big muscly arms, right? Okay, let's see if this continues next. Oh gosh, are her eyes open or closed? Closed. Is she actually facing him? No. She's kind of looking a bit away. And if he was looking, he would be looking straight into her eyes, except his eyes are closed because he's looking at her with his heart. And she's in his arms. Next. Oh gosh, what do you know? Her eyes are, and she's not looking at him, but he's looking at her, and she's in his arms. Next. Her eyes are closed. She's not looking at him. He's looking at her. He would be looking at her if she would, right? He'd be looking in her eyes if she would let him. And she's in his arms. Also, I don't know why they always talk about guys being like so lusty, but like, no, these guys got shirts on. So anyway, I just side note. Next. Her eyes are closed. He's looking at her. She's in his arms. Next. Eyes are closed, looking away, pushing away. He's looking at her, and she's in his arms. Last one. And this one is a little bit of a break, but she's still got her eyes closed. She's completely given over into his arms. And he's looking straight at her. And so this comes all back to this idea that there are three primary desires for a woman. If we can go to the next one. The three deep desires of a woman. Number one is to be pursued. That's why she's not looking at him. She's playing kind of the hard to get. She wants to be pursued. Next is to be cherished. She wants to be his one and only. And lastly is to be safe. She's in his arms. Now, I wanted to find the same kind of counterpart for men, but men don't read. So we couldn't use books. So I decided to find something that was just maybe a little bit more marketed to men that they don't really need. And I thought, well, probably movies. So let's look at movie posters, action movie posters specifically. Boom. Okay. Are his eyes open or closed? Open. And he's looking. Obviously, what does he have in his hands? A weapon. He's got a weapon, and he's facing somebody, I don't know, probably somebody trying to sell solar panels for his roof or something, and behind him where's the woman? She's behind him, and she's obviously alarmed and needs him. Let's see if this continues. Next one. Boom. Now, this one's a little bit more modern, but still, the woman is where? Behind him. Are his eyes open or closed? Open. What's he looking at? He's obviously looking at an enemy. And what does he have in his hand? A weapon. Now, she has a weapon, But he's clearly, and here's the other thing. He's not looking at the same thing she is. Did you notice that? Slightly different. She's maybe looking, and then all around them are kind of the hazards. The enemies are just kind of in the background. Next one. Boom. Eyes open or closed? Open. What's in his hand? A weapon. What's he looking at? And this one, I don't know. It's like you can't really tell. I mean, he's not ready to strike, but he's definitely looking at the horizon. And in the back, you can see, obviously, there's an enemy. There's the British attacking. And the woman is in there, but she's in the back. She's behind. And she's facing him. Next. Eyes open and closed. Open. Where's the woman? Behind him. What's he got in his hand? Weapon. What's he looking at? Probably an enemy. However, the weapon's not pointing the same way he's looking. Almost as if he's looking beyond the enemy. And, of course, all surrounding them is this enemy of biblical proportions. And next. Boom. Eyes open or closed? Open. Where's the woman? Behind him. She's looking at him. She's alarmed. She needs him. What's he got in his hand? Weapon. Where's he looking? The horizon. If he's looking at an enemy, I don't know if you've noticed in all of these guys are all smiling. Right? They're all smiling. There is an idea that they're looking at something that's causing them great joy and fulfillment. So, next. Even if we're mocking hero movies, his eyes are open. He's standing up there. The family's clinging to him. They are alarmed. He is smiling and he's looking. I don't know what he's got in his hand. I don't remember the movie, but he's got something in his hand. And next. This one breaks a little bit because you say, well, he doesn't have a weapon in his hands because his hands are a weapon, right? Because he can take on a silverback gorilla without anything. But he does have a weapon there at the ready. His eyes are open, but he's not even looking at the enemy, is he? That's going to be key here. He's looking beyond the enemy. Where's the woman? Behind him. Evidently, wardrobe malfunction. But anyway, you get the general idea. Let's look at the three concepts here. The three desires of men is, number one, to be needed. Or I'm going to modify this. This is something that I present to kids at our school a bit. But or to be followed. The next one is to be respected. And the last one is to matter, to be significant. That's the reason that he's looking off to the horizon. He's looking off to the horizon. The idea is somehow he's got to live for something bigger than himself. All right, so now these, and you might want to take issue with some of these, but I think for the most part, if we understand that these are generically or generally kind of the differences between the desires of man and woman, that's going to help us in this idea of pursuing. Because the truth is to pursue somebody, you've got to know where they're going, right? You've got to know what's going on inside of them. And so with this, I want to pursue onto the next idea that in pursuit, I always come back to the greatest commandment. There's a couple key passages, right? And it's the Great Commission, the greatest commandment. These are like anchor passages within the scripture. And a lot of times I think when we think of love, especially words that we use in English way too often, like love, because we use it for everything. I love my wife, of course, and I love pizza, but it's not the same thing. So we have to be able to like go, well, what does the Bible talk about when it's talking about love? And so in this perspective, I want to go back to the greatest commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That there are facets, there is a depth of love that we need to consider when we are pursuing our spouse, when we're pursuing that kind of love. So first of all, spiritually, how do we love our spouse with all our soul? Now, there was a pastor and theologian back in the 1800s. His name was Theodore Hesburger. He has a very famous saying, the most important thing a father can do for his children is to love their mother. And that resonates, doesn't it? If you have children, you just go like, yeah, I get that. That's true. I would like to extrapolate that curve a little bit and voice it in terms of marriage. And I would put it this way. The most important thing a spouse can do for their beloved is to love Jesus, is to love their God. Because, you see, we don't have anything in us that we squeeze and love comes out. We think we do, but we don't. Granted, we might be pretty naturalistic at eros, at erotic love. But when it comes to Philadelphia, that, you know, that friendship love, that e-harmony love, you know, the truth is that that only goes so far because we're sinners. Storge, the idea of family love, Bible doesn't even say that we have storge. It says we're a storge. It says we don't have family love. And really the goal is agape love, that it's that self-sacrificing love, that divine love. We don't produce that. We have to tap into the well. So the reason, I think that's the reason it's so important for us to pursue Christ first. He's the source of that love. And we're just the conduit of it. If you've ever, Wiersbe's statement, right? It's divine resources meeting human needs through loving channels to the glory of God. There's this idea that we are just the conduit of that love. And so I think it's extremely important as spouses that we love Jesus first. Now, I've got one more little visual for you that I'm going to get to here in just a second. Remember, it does have audio. Remember, if you've done any marriage counseling, gone through marriage counseling, you'll talk about the love triangle. The idea that any marriage is a union of three. You have God and you have the husband, you have the wife. And the only way that you're going to really get the husband and wife together is you got to get closer to God. You've got to pursue God. Now, I recall I was meeting with Doug Keene. We were in England. He's driving me to the airport. And we were just going through one of these things. It's a long drive. And it's like, well, hey, you know, who's been some of your spiritual mentors and idols and stuff like that? And, you know, Spurgeon, Owen Moody, you know, Chuck Smith. And we're going through all these names. And we're just kind of going back and forth. And so it was his turn. And he says, you're never going to know this guy. His name's Tom Nelson. I go, Tommy Nelson from Denton Bible? He goes, yeah. I said, he's my old pastor. He goes, no way. And so Doug says, he had a teaching that changed my life. And as soon as he said that, I knew the teaching that Tommy had said that really kind of struck me. And as soon as he started talking about it, I'm like, I know that teaching. I was sitting there in the room. He had heard it through a tape because he was in England. I was sitting in the room. Now, I preface this because then I was watching television and I saw a Levi's commercial and it was Tommy's teaching. I don't think Levi's knew that. And so I want to show you the video and then I want to describe to you what the teaching is. So we'll see if this works. Teaching was, how do you find your mate? And in the teaching it says, you run after God with all you have. And so the idea is obviously he had to open the door, he had to get a running start. There's no way he could have skipped up to that wall, he would have been knocked back on his tail. He was going full tilt. It says, and as you're running after God with everything you are, you keep your peripheral vision open. And when you see somebody who's running the same direction as you are and going to, and keeping up, then you just kind of look over and you wave and she waves and you join hands and you keep running after God. That was his teaching. And the idea is when you see this in the video, it was just so perfect because you see they're running, she's keeping up. And then you notice that in marriage, it's not an additive property. Like if you have a strength of 5 and your wife has a strength of 5, together you have a strength of 10. It's not like that. God's biblical pattern is that when you join together in relationship, it's logarithmic. The power is increased greatly. So they don't then go running through another gypsum wall. They go through a stone wall and then run up trees and go into heaven. That's perfect, right? And so the idea here is that in this, and when I'm counseling, especially young people, and I'm going to get to the point here eventually. When counseling young people, the idea is like if, because they're always in love and they're always crushing on each other, it's like if you have to stop and turn around and go back, it's the wrong person. I know a lot of you are thinking like, why didn't I see that Levi's commercial before? So anyway, but the idea is that you're running and what I tell girls is, and ladies, you need to see his Levi's tag. He should be in front of you because he's supposed to be the spiritual leader. All right, so gentlemen, all this is a setup to trap you, is to say that you are to be the spiritual leader. So when it says love Jesus first, it shouldn't be your wife getting you up out of bed to go to church. It should be you getting up and getting your family ready to go to church. You're the spiritual leader. You're the one who's pursuing the scriptures. And the thing is that I will also, but ladies, that it's also, how do you love your husband? You have to love God first. You have to be plugged into church. You have to be having your own personal devotional life. You have to be pressing into Christ first. He is the source of love for your partner. And so it's Jesus first. If that's the point, how do I love my spouse? How do I pursue my spouse with all my soul? It is to love Jesus first. And you see, this is what sets Christian marriage apart from all others, is that we're dealing with a uniqueness and an exclusivity, that we are searching for a mate and building into a mate something that's different from this world. And we see that in the Song of Solomon's. It's Songs chapter 2, verses 2. It says, like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. That's the groom speaking of his wife. The wife speaking of her groom, like an apple tree among the pines, so is my beloved among the young men. The idea is that we're looking for something different than the world. We're looking for a Christian mate. We are looking to build in our mate their Christ-likeness, because that's the source of all of our agape. That's the source of all of our love. That's how we love with all our soul. But how do we pursue then with all of our mind? And with our mind, I would say that the big key here is to know your spouse deeply. You have to become the expert on them. You have to know their fears, their joys, and their hopes. And you might say, and for guys, that's scary. It's like, well, how do I know a woman? How do I truly know her? I have a book. I forwarded it on to Jason. It's a book, and it's called Everything Man Has Learned About Women. And I gave it to Jason because I was through with it. But essentially, it's full of blank paper. There's nothing in it. There's no words. Everything that man's learned about women. There's just nothing in there. And there's an old adage, and the idea is, how can a man know a woman? You know, how can a man know what his wife wants? And the answer is, just listen the next time she's screaming it at you, right? But that's not true. Because women don't necessarily say it. They just think we should know it intuitively, and they test us. And that's why, ladies, whenever you ask your husband even the most basic question, all the blood drains out of his face, right? Because you say something that seems really simple, like, hey, do you like this shirt? At which point you'll see him just go like, oh crud, right? Because I can tell you what he's thinking. He's going, is this a real question? This is a trick question. Am I supposed to like this shirt? I don't know. Do I like this shirt? How long has she owned this shirt? Was I supposed to notice she just bought this shirt, or maybe she had this shirt for a long time? I'm not exactly sure. So he's just going, ah, right? And the thing is that, ladies, you go, this is a simple question. It's a simple question for women. It's not a simple question for men. I remember one time, I'm really trying. I want to get my wife the best Christmas present. We're in the mall. And so I'm saying, hey, you know, just, you know, kind of, you know, I'm watching to see what she likes. And she walks up to this blouse and she goes, oh, look at this. I really like this. And she's smiling. And I'm thinking, bam, I've nailed it. I act cool like I didn't even notice. Yeah, whatever. And then so I sneak away later. I go back to the mall. I buy it. And I wrap it up. And it's Christmas. It's like, I nailed it. I got her. Think she doesn't even know I bought it, right? And she opens it up and she's like, why did you buy this? I said, it's the shirt. You said you liked it. She thought I was joking. She says, look at this. Obviously. I'm like, obviously. That's the most ridiculous word. Obviously, this isn't the right shirt. This is coming like women's clothing is obvious, right? It's like if they wear high-waisted pants up to their armpits, low-waisted pants way too low. They either wear shoulder pads and make them look like a 50s Cadillac, or halterless makes it look like a caterpillar's eating them. Like, there's nothing obvious about women's clothing. The sizing's not obvious. It's like six. Six what? Six units. Six dress units or something. And it's like there's nothing obvious. And so here's the idea. How, gentlemen, are we going to know our wives deeply? You ready? Ask. What's your greatest fear? What's your greatest dreams? What do you like? You got to talk to them, right? We have to. I remember when Dorothy and I first got together, we'd just sit there. Tell me something I don't know about you. Just tell me something I don't know about you. Tell me about when you were little. Tell me. Right? It all came very naturally in the beginning, right? Which is very natural. I just want to know more about you. I want to know more about you. The thing is that it's not like we hit 18 and quit growing. We're continuing to develop. We're continuing to mature. We're continuing to grow. So we have to continue to ask, what is it that moves you deeply? And And the idea of learning about your spouse. Remember we talked about those needs. One of her needs was, our deepest desire was to be pursued. In Songs chapter 2, verse 9, it says, "My beloved is like a gazelle or like a young stag. Behold, he is standing behind the wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice." He's pursuing her. I heard this line. It says, "My girlfriend thinks I'm a stalker." Well, she's not exactly my girlfriend yet. But anyway. But the idea here is he's pursuing her. It's meeting her need, asking her. All right, her need is to be pursued. His need is to be respected, right? Or is to be needed, followed. And so I put for the women, just mock interest in his hobbies. Because let's face it, I don't care who the man is. I don't care if he's barely literate. There's going to be something that he knows, like just you mentioned Chevy engines or something, and all of a sudden he goes off like a PhD, right? Every man has got this passion, and so even though it's probably nothing that you're too terribly, horribly interested in, if you show interest in it, he actually feels like he matters. And so there's, again, these things. I'm just going to just put it out there. In every way that we love, remember that the key of love in the Christian context is selfless love. We are not alike at all. Men and women are not alike. And so the idea is that I'm trying to learn about this woman who's so different from me. She thinks different than me about everything, about shoes and about sex and about shopping and about everything. There's just so much different between us that I'm going to have to at some point let go of me and enter into her world. Ladies, at some point, you're going to have to let go of yourselves and enter into his world and to know them, to become the expert. Because the truth is, as spouses, we are the experts on our beloveds. We are the experts. And that is something that doesn't end. We just have to continue exploring and learning about our spouse as we grow, as we mature, as we enter into that next stage of life. And I want to give you a special hot tip on how to do this. Pray together. Now, I'm going to give you even better hot tips on pray together. Don't just sit down and pray together because I don't know about you, but I close my eyes, I'm in the Bahamas. So my wife and I have found that prayer walks are awesome. So we just go and we just walk in our neighborhood. We walk someplace. Sometimes we even drive somewhere because it's prettier than our neighborhood. And we'll walk through somebody else's neighborhood and we will pray. Because our eyes are open, we're walking. And then here's another hot tip. One is a prayer walk. The second one is when you pray, popcorn prayer, which means you just pray for one thing and then you let the other one pray. Like, you don't go on for 45 minutes and then the other, because the other one just takes it, is you just go back and forth about your needs and then walk longer than you pray. Whether you just talk first and then pray, or whether you pray first and then talk, it's just a great way to learn about each other, because it's not just that I want to learn about your mind or your heart with your spouse. It's like, I want to learn what God's speaking to you. I want to learn your soul, right? And so that's the next idea. So it's the idea of loving our spouse with all of our mind. Know them deeply. So the first one with the soul, love Jesus first. Second one with the mind, become the expert. Know your spouse deeply. Pray with them. Next one is heart. I think the key here is don't fix your spouse. It's not your job to fix your spouse. It's your job to fill them. And so once you've started to learn about their fears and their desires, you need to fill them. It says in Songs chapter 1, the bride is speaking, "Do not stare at me because I'm swarthy. For the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard." So here we see in the bride in the Song of Solomon, she feels ugly. She's had to work the field. She's had a hard life. She's had her wounds in her past. And she doesn't necessarily feel attractive. And gentlemen, I'm going to say that in our current culture, that's all of our wives. Our culture is very cruel to women. And it sets ridiculous expectations on women. And I think it's super important that we understand that our wife is our standard of beauty. And all throughout the Song of Songs, the groom will call his beloved most beautiful among women. That's what he always calls her. He says, "But if you do not know most beautiful among women." And in chapter 4, and without jumping on to one of the other topics, I want to just show you how he loves her emotionally, how he fills her. It's in chapter 4, and it's the admiration of the bride. It's the groom admiring his bride. He says, "How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil." By the way, this, I believe, is their wedding night. It says, "Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead." He's falling. Her hair is down, which kind of gives you a clue in the ancient Near East that this isn't on the street, because she wouldn't have her hair down. This is an intimate setting. And so and I'm sure she feels a bit vulnerable wedding night, right? He says, "Like a flock of goats, your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes." Obviously, he's using metaphors here. But he says, "A newly shorn sheep would be very white." So he says, "Your teeth are like newly shorn ewes. They're white, which have come up out of their washing. They're clean. Her teeth are clean. Her teeth are white. Her teeth are clean. And not one of them has lost her young." Her teeth are there. So it's really good, right? So she's... He's admiring her mouth. And then he says, "Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely." So he is just praising her physically. He's cherishing her. And he says, "Your temples or your cheeks are like slices of pomegranates behind your veil." She's blushing. As he's speaking to her, she's blushing. And then he says, "Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty men." And you're kind of going, what, your neck is a tower? In other words, instead of her going like, "I'm swarthy, don't look at me, don't gaze at me," and she's down, now what is she doing? Look what he's doing to her. He's building her up. He says, "Your neck is like a tower." Her chin is up. He's filling her tank. Are you with me? It's like she's blossoming under his words. And he said, "Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies." He's like, "Your skin is like the petals of a flower." And obviously obviously this is a husband-wife thing. "Until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense." Until this cool of the day and the shadows flee away, that's talking about the morning. So he's saying all night long, He says, I will be, and he refers to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. Throughout the book of the Song of Solomon, the groom will respond to the hills of Bethar or Bether, which means the hills of cleavage. And so he's talking about her breasts. He's talking about, I'm going to cling to you all night long. I'm going to be with you, and I'm going to be close to you, so that close enough to smell you all night long until the morning. He says, you are altogether beautiful, my darling, and there is no blemish in you. You have, okay, right here. You are altogether beautiful and there's no blemish in you. She just said, I've been a worker in the fields. I've been burnt. I've been abused. He says, I see no blemish. All right, so you notice, first of all, he's using metaphor. Hot tip, guys. Use metaphors. Right? Don't go, and your eyes are round and your hair's brown. You have two arms. Like, you get a little, you know. Do some research and use some metaphors or something here. But notice that what he's using the metaphor is to bring out the beauty, to notice that which is beautiful. And he is purposefully overlooking the scars and the blemishes and the imperfections. Because remember, she's your standard of beauty. She doesn't feel like it. And it wouldn't matter, to be honest, guys. You probably know. I'm sure you can think of couples. I can think of couples. Beautiful couples. That get divorced. Beautiful couples that have adulterous affairs. Because it doesn't matter that the whole world thinks they're beautiful. If their spouse doesn't think they're beautiful, they're not beautiful. And so I think that's really clear. To understand that when we go through the vows with God, we're not dealing with a normal person. We're dealing with the exception, the only person that matters. And that's why the words are important, is because our beloved, our spouse, has an access to chambers of our heart that nobody else on the planet has access to. So we have a power and an influence over our spouse that nobody else has. And so I think it's important here that he's using metaphor. He is basically exalting everything he finds beautiful in her. He says, there's no blemish in you. He said, you have made my heart beat faster. My sister, my bride. Remember that phrase, my sister, my bride. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine. Your fragrance of your oils better than all spices. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. And the fragrance of your garment is like the fragrance of Lebanon. And so how does he know what it tastes like under her tongue? Oh, they're kissing, right? So obviously, this is an intimate relationship. But in this intimacy, he's just calling out everything that's good about her. And it's building her up. And the idea there is there's this need. He's filling her tank. Her desire is to be cherished. He's filling her tank. Now, there's another text. I'm going to jump over to Song chapter 5, and it's the admiration of the groom. You'll notice there's a difference here. Again, don't fix your spouse. Fill him. His greatest fear is failing, being disrespectful, not mattering. So you need to speak life, not criticism, into him. And so listen to how she does it for him. My beloved is dazzling and ruddy. Outstanding among 10,000. His head is like fine gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. Okay, they were young. All right, so. His eyes are like doves behind streams of water, bathed in milk, not bloodshot, and reposed in their setting. His cheeks are like balsam, banks of sweet-scented herbs. His lips are lilies dripping with myrrh. She's not talking about how his lips taste. She's talking about the fragrance, the aroma. In other words, she's talking about his words. Your lips drip myrrh. Your words heal me. Your words bless me, right? She says, your hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His abdomen is carved ivory and laid with sapphires. Just want to remind you that you can carve ivory into any shape you want. Just in case you were revisioning something, it can be any shape, just like carved ivory. Okay, His legs are pillars of alabaster set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is as choice as Lebanon, like the cedars. His mouth is full of sweetness. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. I don't know if you noticed it, but she said his head is gold, his hands are gold, his feet are gold. What does that mean, gold? Gold is a medal of divinity. It's a medal of nobility. She's not saying about how beautiful he is. She's saying, and this is also a Hebraic idiom in reference to head, hands, and feet. You'll notice that when they anointed the priests in the Old Testament, they anointed the ear and the hands and the feet. This is the thought that the head represents all that a man thinks. It represents all of his ideas. His hand represents all of his actions, all that he does. His feet represents his goals and his motives. She says, your thoughts are royal. She respects him. Your hands are like gold. She respects him. Your feet are headed. They're like gold. I respect your vision. I respect your I respect what God speaks to you. I respect the way I respect the work you do. I respect the thoughts you think. She's not talking about like how pretty he is. Because where does he need to be filled? Does he want to be chosen? No, he wants to be respected. He wants to matter. And so you see how, and then here's the other part. She says, O daughters of Jerusalem. She's talking to someone else. She talks to him, but she's talking to someone else. And I just want to say, ladies, the way you talk about your husband in other places is extremely important. I know there have been times when I've been counseling with somebody and some lady will just go off about what a creep her husband is, what a jerk, what a clod her husband is. And I completely lose respect for that woman. I'm like, seriously, you would trash your beloved in front of me? I think I can see part of the problem here. Because you see, just as the woman needs to be cherished, the man needs to be respected. You see the difference in the way that they're blessing? And so they're blessing and they're moving forward. So with this emotionally, we don't fix our spouses. We fill them. Gentlemen, it's not your job to tell a woman how to be a wife. That's God's job and her sister's job. Ladies, it's not your job to tell your husband how to be a husband. It's God's job and his brother's job. Because if you're critiquing, if we're critiquing, if we're trying to fix the other one, has that ever worked? You might be thinking like, well, I'm he's rough around the edges, but I'll marry him. I'll fix that. No, you won't. You're not going to do that. You see, we're the biggest fan club of our spouse. It's not our job to critique them. The world does that. It's our job to fill them emotionally. Does that make sense? And then finally, how do we love with all of our strength? How am I doing on time? And my point here would be what comes naturally in courtship has to come on purpose in the course of the marriage. We did a lot of things naturally when we first met someone. We showed great interest in them. We're very selfless. I'm sure that, you know, when you were courting, you laughed at all of his jokes, whether they were funny or not. You just laughed. Your little laughs found like diamonds. And then you got married and then he tells a joke and you're like, really? And so it changed, right? The idea is what happened normally during courtship, we have to do on purpose. That takes some strength. That takes some energy. And so, in Psalm chapter 2, there's also a job that the men have over the wife. With your strength, you're to protect her. Psalm chapter 2, O my dove in the cleft of the rocks. The dove is hiding in the rocks. It's fearful. In the secret places, in the steep pathways. The world is dangerous. Let me see your form. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your form is lovely. There's an idea that with our strength, gentlemen, that we're supposed to protect our wives. When the bride is talking about her husband in Song chapter 3, she says, behold, here is the traveling couch of Solomon, 60 mighty men around it. of the mighty men of Israel, all of them are wielders of the sword, experts in war. Each man has his sword at his side, guarding against the terrors of the night. So there's this idea that the woman is a weaker vessel, and with part of our strength, we have to protect her from our own tone, from our own anger, but also from the world. That is part of what we do. But women, there is a way that with your strength, you have to feed your husband. And that is that you need to encourage him in the visions. Because God will speak. If we get in the proper line of authority, God will speak to the husband. The issue is that sometimes the call of God is scary. It's a walk of faith, right? And a man's already kind of on shaky ground because he's trying to work on his faith. And I would just encourage you ladies that if he tells you of a dream that he believes the Lord is speaking, you need to speak life into that vision. I remember it was coming upon a time we were, Dorothy and I were out at Murrieta, and we were staying in one of the little bungalows at the Bible College. It was like a little 300 square foot little room with a little bathroom off to the side. And the truth is we were entering into a point of our life. I'm not sure where our ministry was going to go. And I was just worried. I started getting worried about the whole thing and retirement and how you're improvising all of this stuff. And she stands and right in the middle of this, she goes, "We could make this work." I said, "What are you talking about? This room. You know, if we had to, we could live here. It's a little 300 square foot." She's like, "I could put a couple little chairs here. We could eat here. We could make a little kitchen on this side. It's already got a bathroom. We could make something like this work." And I was like, "So we can go anywhere?" Because I'm hearing God saying, like, you know, there's a call of God. And she's willing, instead of a mansion, instead of all this stuff, she's like, "You know, we could make it work with this." And I'm like, man, do I have a courageous wife. And that allowed me to dream. It wasn't like, oh, I have to keep up with the Joneses or anything like that. It's like, no, my bride's not, she's not motivated by that. She's motivated by, like, God, wherever God leads us, let's go. And I know that's not easy for her. Right? Because obviously God has placed in our wives the desire to raise up children safely, which is really good. Because, you know, Funny Home Videos is just all about dads messing up their kids, right? We're dangerous for our children. That's why we need a wife. And so she's, and I remember one time, and think about this when you're sharing your ideas, make sure you're sharing God's vision and not your angst. I think I came home one time and I was really mad at my supervisor or my boss or whatever. And I'm like, I'm just going to quit. And Dorothy got really kind of mad at me about that. Just like, I'm just threatening to quit. Because, you know, as men, it's like, I just need a stick and a hamburger. And I can go anywhere. I can do anything. And so I was explaining to a Christian brother. I'm like, she got really upset when I threatened to quit. And he goes, "Well, because you have children. She's trying to build a nest. And you're back here sawing off the branch." And I'm like, oh, I didn't think about that. We have to think about, you know, not everything that comes through our mouth is the vision of God. We got to be careful. Sometimes it's just our testosterone venting our spleen about our anger. And we got to protect our wives from that, too, because they want to know that, like, you are hearing from God. Because, women, you can submit to a man, especially if you know he's following God. Who leads the leader? If Jesus is leading him, it's like, yeah. You can be really courageous. But gentlemen, that means that probably some of the wild ideas that we get, maybe we just need to keep to ourselves. We need to protect our spouse in these ideas. And so as we get to that, what comes naturally during courtship, we need to do on purpose. So I would say as something under here, continue to date your spouse. Continue to date. Make sure that you have that time set aside just to be with your spouse. But also with your strength. And what I'm going to say is the reason that's strength is because you did that. We just didn't have the perseverance. We just let it go. Some things we just say, oh, that's not needed anymore. And you see, that's a lack of strength. It's not how you start, it's how you finish. And we have to finish well, which means those things that we were doing, we can't let go of those. Right? Remember, it was like Joseph said last night, sometimes it's the little things. Right? In the song it said, let us catch the foxes, the little foxes that are messing up our garden. You see, Satan, hopefully after you've been married for some period of time and you've been saved, Satan's not going to come through the front door very easily because you've got that figured out. But it doesn't mean that he's not sending in the little foxes. And so we have to be very purposeful to continue to court our spouse, to continue to date them, to continue to spend that time with them. But also with our strength, we really, really need to learn how to fight clean. It's super important that because we're going to conflict. It's two sinners in one home until death do you part. There's going to be conflict. But we have to learn how to fight clean. And so as a testimony to that, we didn't know. When Dorothy and I got married, I was 19. I'm an only child. I'm an only grandchild. I am the center of the universe. And my wife was the baby girl. And she was the center of the universe. When you put two center of the universes, immature center of the universes in the same home, you reach critical mass and it goes nuclear. And so the beginning of our marriage was horrible. Absolutely horrible. We were both saved, barely. I mean, we'd been saved for a couple months. And at one point, our next door neighbor came over, knocked on the door. And I opened the door. I said, yeah. She said, hey, could you do me a favor? I said, oh, absolutely. Thing like she wants a cup of sugar or something, right? She says, could you guys either get a divorce or move? And I'm like, I beg your pardon? She says, could you guys get a divorce or move? Because you're freaks. I can't live next to you anymore. And so that kind of tells you how the beginning of our relationship was going. And so it was. We were horrible to each other, screaming and yelling and knocking holes in the wall and doing the whole nine yards. It was just horrible. And so, and partially it was because I couldn't go to my parents. I didn't want their marriage. She didn't want her parents' marriage. We didn't really have the model. We had to go to our second family, our church family. And we had to look for men and women who actually loved each other. And when we find them, it's like, so you guys love each other? Yeah. How do you do that? And we got mentored in our Bible study from some great couples. And we got mentored by my grandparents who had a godly marriage. And they taught us about this. And I want you to know that if a start like that, where the next door neighbor wants us to get a divorce, it was a huge jump to when my son, while he was getting premarital counseling, calls me up and says, Dad, I need your help. I'm like, absolutely. What is it, buddy? He says, how does this whole submission thing work? I'm like, what? We're doing the study on the roles and submission. And how do we do that? Because I never saw you and Mom fight. You were always on the same page. How does this work? I'm like, oh, simple, son. We didn't fight in front of you. Of course we conflicted, but we had a plan. So what we were taught by these wonderful godly people, you don't fight in front of your kids. So something would happen. Somebody would say something stupid, usually me. And, you know, I don't know, the boys go, hey, Dad, can we jump off the roof? Sure, go for it. Right? And then Dorothy would give me the eye. You know that. And so it would be like, time out, guys. Why don't you watch some cartoons? Your mom and I will be right back. And we'd walk to the next room and we'd close the door. And we wouldn't start yelling because you can hear through the door. So we'd start whispering really forcibly, right? And we'd be figuring this out. Are you an idiot? You know, and we're going back and forth, blah, blah, blah. And we had a rule. Whenever it was getting too emotional, either one of us were able, I'll finish up with this, I'm out of time. Either one of us were able at any time to say, I need to pray. We knew that it wasn't a power play. We gave each other permission that when we were getting too emotional, it's like, I need 5 minutes. And then we would go and we would pray and we'd try to cool off and we'd try to hear from God. And then we'd come back and we'd do it again. And if we had to do that a couple of times, well, whatever we had to do until we finally came to a conclusion and we were on the same page again, at which point we opened the door, arm in arm, come walking back in and explain, hey, boys, remember I said you could jump off the roof? Yeah, I was thinking about it. No, you can't. Right? And of course, all they ever saw is Mom and Dad together, smiling, in agreement. And it was also the same thing, and I want to encourage you, for those of you who have kids, if your child comes up to ask you to do something, your first response is, what did your mother say? Right? Or what did your father say? And if they said no, even if you think yes, you go, oh, no. And you guys have a unified front. If you can go back and you can revisit it in the quiet whisper behind some door somewhere, pray and whisper until you get it figured out, Then come back in and make sure that you're on the same page. Now, that works with your kids, works with your boss. It works with the rest of your life. Your spouse, you guys got to be on the same page. Satan is going to try to divide you. You got to stay together. So here's the whole thing. To pursue our spouse, we have to pursue him spiritual. Love Jesus first. Go after him with all you got. With your mind, how do you love your spouse? You've got to be the expert on your spouse. And that probably means you also got to pray with them. With all your heart, you want to, don't fix them. It's not your job to fix your spouse. It's your job to fill them, understand their deepest needs. And then with all your strength, the things that came naturally in the beginning, you do on purpose later. And you make sure that you continue to date each other and you continue to have that strength of fortitude and perseverance all the way until one of you quits breathing and you fight clean. Does that make sense? Father, we praise you and we thank you for all your many blessings. We thank you that, Lord, that you have given us your word. You have given us your blood. You have given us your spirit. You have given us your church. And so we have everything we need for life and godliness. And we have everything we need to have a marriage that is a light in a dark world. We thank you, God, that you've been so generous to us. We give you the praise and the glory in Jesus' name. Amen.